This is Dr. Shannon M. Clark with A Doctor Delivers Podcast, and today I am discussing the role of progesterone as well as progesterone supplementation for fertility and pregnancy with reproductive endocrinology and infertility specialist, Dr. Lucky Seacon. Have a listen. Okay, this is Dr. Shannon M. Clark with Babies After 35 and on Instagram and my social media channels, as well as at Dr. Delivers Podcast on anywhere you listen to podcasts. And today I'm joined by Dr. Lucky Seacon, a reproductive endocrinology and infertility specialist out of New York with RMA Fertility. So tell me what your Instagram handle is.
At lucky.seacon. So just my name, very simple.
At lucky.seacon. And then also you have a blog called The Lucky Egg, which is super cute.
Thank you. I have been building it for the last 2 years, and I just try to address commonly asked questions and areas of confusion for my patients.
Right. And you do a very good job. For those of you guys that know me here, I share a lot of stuff with Dr. Seacon, and I collaborate with her quite often, but there's a reason behind that. We kind of connected, I don't know, maybe a year ago, and we just are very like-minded. And when you have an MFM and a fertility doc that are kind of along the same lines, you know, that's really a great combo. So we thought we would just, you know, let this relationship blossom, and here we are today.
Yes, we are a great team, and I really love doing these with you, so thanks for having me.
So I was super excited when you agreed to do this talk on progesterone, because progesterone seems to be the it hormone right now for all things fertility and pregnancy, and there's reasons why it should be, of course. But what I wanted to do is talk about starting with ovulation and going into what we know about progesterone for the prevention of preterm birth, and talk about the evidence and what we do and do not know. Why? Because I see a lot of double, triple dipping in different hormone therapies, especially progesterone for fertility reasons, miscarriage reasons, preterm birth reasons, where people are on oral, intramuscular, vaginal, I mean, all kinds. And I want to kind of just put out there, according to ASRM, which is the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, which Dr. Seacon is a member of, and then for myself, like ACOG, we're both members of that, and then SMFM for me, what they recommend based on the totality of the evidence. Are you down for that?
I am down. I think this is such a great topic.
Yeah, I think it is too. So let's start with you. Tell me about the role of progesterone with ovulation. So let's start there.
Right. So let's talk about ovulation within a 28-day menstrual cycle, even though we know everyone has different length menstrual cycles and is an individual, just for the sake of, you know, teaching about the menstrual cycle and what ovulation means. If you have a 28-day cycle, the first day of your cycle is the first day of your period, right? And in order to get to the next period, you have to ovulate. And ovulation is the release of an egg from the ovary. And you have a bunch of eggs that get randomly selected to be in play that cycle, and your brain, your pituitary gland in your brain, sends a signal to the ovary that will randomly select one of those eggs to mature over the course of the next 2 weeks if you have that 28-day cycle. And then additional signals from the brain, known as luteinizing hormone, will be sent out to signal the release of the egg from that mature follicle. And once that egg is released, it can be fertilized or it can basically disintegrate and go away. When that egg is released, that follicle that was housing that egg now goes from producing just estrogen in that first 2 weeks of the menstrual cycle to now becoming a progesterone-producing factory. And the purpose behind that is basically progesterone is a pregnancy hormone. It is necessary to convert the lining of your uterus to become receptive to receiving that embryo so that it can implant, and it can sustain implantation. It causes a relaxation effect on the uterine muscles, and it can help a pregnancy to continue and flourish. And it will support that process until the placenta takes over at around 7 to 10 weeks. And what's causing that corpus luteum, which is the name of the follicle that's now producing both estrogen and progesterone, what's causing it to produce that progesterone is actually the signal coming from an embryo. So if that egg, once it's ovulated, actually gets fertilized and over the course of a week turns into an embryo and makes its way to the uterus and actually successfully implants, it's going to start sending a signal back to the ovary to say, hey, keep making progesterone. I'm here and I need you. And so the HCG from the pregnancy that has successfully implanted and is hopefully healthy is going back to the ovary, and it's continuing that process of progesterone release. And let's say that it's not a healthy pregnancy, right? Because most healthy unhealthy pregnancies are stemming from the fact that the embryo is abnormal, not all, but some of them are. That embryo might start to kind of peter out and stop producing the HCG just because it's not capable of it. And that signal dies down and then the progesterone production drops. So it's always a case of what came first, the chicken or the egg. We need to come up with a better analogy because it's confusing. Yeah. But a lot of patients will think that their low progesterone levels caused miscarriages when in fact it's more of a symptom.
Right. So it's probably from it not being a healthy pregnancy. And I was reading up on that because, you know, this is not my area of expertise. I learned about it in medical school and in residency.
Right.
But, you know, the thought, are you thinking that, or people think that either it's because the pregnancy is not healthy, which is not allowing the progesterone, or there's something innately wrong that doesn't allow the body to produce progesterone. But the way it looks, according to most data, is that it's the first, meaning that it's not a healthy pregnancy. And as a result, the progesterone levels are low, which is a key important factor to consider, especially when people start supplementing early threatened miscarriages and those with recurrent pregnancy loss with progesterone. And we'll talk about that in a second. But you mentioned that the placenta starts to take over at 7 to 10 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So the first scenario I want to bring up is if, what if, because we know that the corpus luteum can form a cyst on the ovary and cause an ovarian cyst. It's very common. I see a lot of first trimester ultrasounds, dating ultrasounds with cysts on them, and it's likely from the corpus luteum cyst, but they're causing no issues. Rarely, that cyst might rupture and bleed and cause an issue and where the cyst has to be removed. And if we think it's a corpus luteum cyst and we're at less than that 10-week window, what do we do?
We need to then give progesterone because we might be taking away that progesterone-producing factory.
Right.
And they actually have really interesting early experiments in my field where they studied these things on apes, primates, and they actually would go and remove the corpus luteum and, and prove that, you know, that is required for a pregnancy to persist and be successful.
Right. So just to put this pearl out there, if you are pregnant and you have to have a cyst removed at less than 10 weeks of gestation because it ruptured or it's got big and it torsed, causing ovarian torsion, just remember that if you're less than 10 weeks, that you need to be on some sort of progesterone supplementation until you get past that 10-week window, 10-week mark, and then the placenta should take over. Now,
and a lot of times it's not explained to patients. It's normal to have a cyst. The word cyst scares people, but all it means is it's a fluid-filled space inside the ovary, right? And in this case, it's a normal part of your biology.
Right, and an overwhelmingly majority of time, even I see these cysts all the time on first trimester ultrasounds. I'm sure you do too. Mm-hmm. They're not causing any issue, and we just leave them alone.
Right.
You know, we don't do anything about them, okay? Now, let's go into the IVF arena, where we're doing fertility treatments. What role does progesterone play with that?
So in IVF, you know, all those eggs that got recruited to the surface of the ovary that are in play, you're trying to utilize each and every one of them. That's the goal. That's what makes IVF more efficient than just relying on the one egg that matures each month. You're trying to get a bunch of eggs to mature and then trying to fertilize as many as you can and grow as many as you can into embryos. And then that gives you a lot of options, right? So when you're utilizing hormones to try to grow as many of those eggs as possible, it's not the normal situation. It's not your normal biology. And it's especially not your normal biology when we go in to extract each of those eggs using a needle through the vaginal wall into the adjacent ovary and draining the fluid from each of those follicles to pick the mature eggs up. That's not the natural process of ovulation. So there's a lot of evidence that if you were to just leave things alone and say, okay, let's extract the eggs and then put an embryo back a week later, that would not be sufficient because those follicles that you drained are not going to behave the same way that a normal corpus luteum or corpus luteal cyst would after ovulation. It's not going to produce a sufficient amount of progesterone. And we've observed that, and there's tons of data from the early days of IVF that showed that progesterone supplementation is necessary in the setting of IVF because it's just not going to be enough on its own, and it's not going to be in a sustained fashion.
So that's why we get to do those lovely progesterone injections in our behinds.
Right. And in the case where you're doing a frozen transfer, then it's even more clear, right? Because now it's not like you just had a bunch of eggs extracted, nothing is happening.
Mm-hmm.
You're not ovulating on your own. So we're mimicking as if you did ovulate. And so progesterone is extra crucial in that scenario.
And the progesterone injections in that situation are given up until what gestational age routinely?
Usually we'll start to taper them, you know, at the 7.5, 8 week mark, but we'll have you off of everything completely by the 9 week mark.
By 9 weeks. Okay. So that's, you know, I've heard various, there's different protocols, and what we're saying here is what's typically standard, but every patient, I want to make sure we just put it out there. Every patient's an individual, and your fertility specialist may deviate a little bit based on their experience or their experience with you. So just because we're saying this here doesn't mean that somebody's wrong, but we're just kind of putting out there what the standard protocols typically are. This is what we talk about it.
One more thing I want to add, because this comes up a lot, is patients after an embryo transfer will do at-home testing, and they'll automatically assume if a home pregnancy test is negative that it didn't work, and they'll rush to get off of their progesterone injections. And I would caution them to never do that, because some home pregnancy tests are not very sensitive, and you may have a very low positive test, and it's worth following it up to make sure you see what the full potential is there. You could be pregnant, and you don't want to stop those injections prematurely because the pregnancy is depending on it.
So that's why you guys always want to do the blood test.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so that's very important that we wait for that. Okay, let's go into, we already talked about the corpus luteum. The role of progesterone in early conception, we talked about that, but I also hear, and I wanted to get your opinion on, providers following progesterone levels, and if it's below a certain level, and this is usually in someone who might have had a miscarriage or multiple miscarriages in the past, and they get pregnant and they'll follow progesterone levels, and then they'll start supplementing them based on a progesterone level. What is the evidence behind that, or is there any evidence to do something like that?
So the reason why anyone would think to supplement in the setting of a pregnancy conceived on your own outside of IVF is this idea that there might be something inherently wrong with your body's ability to produce progesterone, aka a luteal phase defect, right? And this used to be like a common diagnosis in my field that people would throw out all the time and say, oh, you must have a luteal phase defect. That's why you're having infertility. That's why you're having miscarriages. And I'll actually send you a link to that ASRM guideline that recently came out, basically explaining why luteal phase defect is probably not a real thing. Mm-hmm. Yes, you're supposed to have, you know, like a 12 to 14 day luteal phase. Luteal phase means the part of your menstrual cycle that is marked by between ovulation and your next period. Mm-hmm. But we know that everyone's an individual, and this could really range from 11 days to up to 17 days, right? And there are sometimes underlying medical issues that, for a variety of reasons, will lead you to have a really short luteal phase, right? And that is a real phenomenon. It could be problems with your thyroid, high prolactin levels, even things like anorexia or other reasons for your pituitary gland not being able to send those signals out are real organic causes of having a short luteal phase. And we don't really know enough about it and how or whether it directly impacts fertility, but it is theorized to play a role. And if you correct the underlying medical problem, it's going to help normalize the menstrual cycle and correct this issue altogether. So that's one thing. We're not saying that that doesn't exist, but the answer isn't to just throw progesterone. It's right to actually correct the underlying problem of why the cycle is irregular. And then there's this other entity known as, you know, idiopathic, meaning it's not stemming from any known underlying hormonal imbalance or medical problem, but just this idea that inherently some people are just born with ovaries that don't know what to do and don't produce enough progesterone. And we don't really know how to diagnose that to confirm whether or not it exists. There's been a lot of different proposed mechanisms, like you mentioned, like measuring progesterone level 7 days after ovulation. Mm-hmm. This is problematic, and it drives me crazy, and it drives a lot of patients crazy, and they feel anxious about it, because measuring one level is not always going to tell you about the whole picture, because what a lot of people don't realize is these are pulsatile hormones, right? So your pituitary isn't just sending out a steady stream of luteinizing hormone to tell your body to ovulate, it's sending pulses. And there's actual data that shows there can be eightfold times variability in your progesterone level during your luteal phase. Like sometimes you're going to catch it in a trough when it's on the lower end, and sometimes you're going to catch it when it's high. So you can't really just choose one static time point and measure a progesterone level and get the full picture. People have said, well, maybe you measure them daily over the entire luteal phase, that 2 weeks, or if it's a week or a week and a half, and add it up. And if it's less than 80 nanograms per milliliter, then that's that's a diagnosis, but that's really cumbersome. Who's going to do blood draws every single day? And that's still not really proven. And studies have looked at individuals who are known to be fertile versus infertile and having issues with conceiving. And the results are mixed. A lot of them have found no difference with any of these types of measures, whether it's blood work or looking even at the lining of the uterus. That's another way to look at this, right? Sometimes patients would get biopsies of the lining of their uterus, and your uterine lining transforms post-ovulation, post-exposure to progesterone. So you could say, okay, well, the lining should look this way when you take a biopsy of it and look at those cells under the microscope. And so they used to date the lining of the uterus and say, oh, you have a luteal phase defect because your lining is behind, right? It's not, or it's too advanced. And we know that that doesn't work. A, it's not reproducible. Even within the same patient, your cycle can vary, you know, and the results of those tests can vary from cycle to cycle. And B, studies have not shown that it's reliably been able to predict who gets pregnant and who doesn't. And it's really hard to study this, whether you're talking in the same person or between different patients, because if you're trying to understand the difference in a luteal phase between those that don't get pregnant in a certain cycle versus those that do, how do you measure a luteal phase in the pregnant cycle? You never get your period, so you can't calculate that, if that makes sense. So it's difficult because there are no real ways to test for this. There's no standard definition of what a luteal phase defect is. And I suspect for those patients, we're not saying we don't believe you. If you have like only 9 days between your LH surge on an ovulation predictor kit and a period, we're not saying that that problem doesn't exist and that isn't a problem, but you need to have a full investigation. Are there other issues that could be causing that? And I would suspect that there are, because this as an entity in and of itself has not been proven to actually exist.
So I read, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the ASRM has defined a luteal phase less than 10 days as being not the standard, right? Or typical, right?
Correct.
That's still correct. Yeah. Yeah, but I'm so glad you mentioned what you just said, because I remember when I was training, luteal phase defect was a thing, and you know, people were getting diagnosed with it left and right. And what I'm hearing you say is that, yes, people can have a shorter luteal phase, but we got to figure out why.
Yes.
If it's less than 10 days, there might be another underlying reason, and we can't just go say, here's a script for progesterone to correct that. We got to correct why it's happening to begin with, correct?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And also sending a script for progesterone, just to touch on what you said earlier about, you know, patients who are prescribed it in early pregnancy, it's almost like a Band-Aid. Like sometimes it actually continues your abnormal pregnancy for longer, right? Yeah. It's not going to correct if your embryo has the wrong amount of DNA or wrong number of chromosomes. So, you know, I think it's used too often, but I also understand wanting to control the situation. Mm-hmm. I also understand patients wanting things to be simple. Unfortunately, our biology is so complicated and they want to understand. The number one question that I got DMs about in the lead up to our discussion today was, well, what level do I need? Like, we all just want to know what level is normal so we can
What's the magic number?
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, there obviously is no magic number, but over 3 ng/mL tells you a week out from your LH surge or when you think your mid-cycle that you ovulated. But how much progesterone is enough? We don't really have a good answer. The way the lining of the uterus looks, if you look at those cells under the microscope, could look normal and appropriate with levels as low as 2.5, right? And we know that there's certain genes that get turned on and certain proteins that end up being produced. There's all these complex things that are happening in the lining of your uterus to prepare for an implanting embryo. And those that pattern of gene expression appears to be normal with a range of 8 to 18 nanograms per milliliter. So if your progesterone level is, you know, 9, don't freak out because you read a blog that said it should be 15. It's pulsatile, remember that.
Right.
And if it's within that general range, I think that that's a good indicator that it could be a normal, healthy pregnancy. You just have to kind of see how things play out.
Right. That's such a great explanation. You know, I want to make sure people understand what luteal phase defect means and what the evidence is now. According to, we've had a lot more data since I was training in residency 2000, 2004. And, you know, we need to make sure we get to the bottom of it and find out what's really causing it and not just treat it with a Band-Aid, because even then the progesterone still may not work if we're not fixing the underlying cause. So that's a great explanation, Dr. Sikana. I appreciate you explaining it that way. I understand it, but actually I understand it better now, the way you talked about it. And you know, I might just go on and do REI since I think I could just learn from you.
I would love to work with you.
Okay, let's go on to early pregnancy loss. Now, this is a hot one. What is the definition of a threatened miscarriage?
So it's basically when there's vaginal bleeding, but the cervix is closed and the pregnancy is still inside the uterus, right? Mm-hmm. So it could be a miscarriage. There's a threat that a miscarriage mm-hmm. might be impending, but it's not a guarantee.
Right. And what about the thought of low progesterone levels being associated with threatened miscarriages in that situation where we have embryo, yolk sac, gestational sac, maybe even a fetal heart tones, but mm-hmm. there's bleeding with a closed cervix. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we know about progesterone's role in all that?
Well, again, I think most often progesterone is going to be a symptom of the underlying cause of why this might be a miscarriage, right? So like if this is an embryo that stopped developing normally on its own because it's missing something or has a problem, then it's going to stop producing that signal and your corpus luteum is going to stop receiving a signal to tell it to continue to produce progesterone. And then for sure, the dropping progesterone is probably contributing to the bleeding, right? Mm-hmm. Because when progesterone withdrawal happens, the lining starts to break down. So it's all related. Mm-hmm. But is adding progesterone going to, in every single situation, stop the bleeding and reverse that process? No, because mm-hmm. the underlying reason for it is still there.
Right. So ACOG says, for threatened early pregnancy loss or threatened miscarriages, it's always still referred to. The use of progestins is controversial and conclusive evidence supporting their use is lacking. Then the United Kingdom's NICE, it's the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, their guidelines affirm that the evidence is inconclusive, but, mm-hmm. quote, data from meta-analysis of several small studies suggest that progesterones might be better than placebo. So, but those are small studies, and, you know, there's nothing, no large studies have been done that have proven it. And there's limitations to these studies, and mm-hmm. are people with threatened miscarriages getting given progesterone? Probably. And mm-hmm. I think it's probably because the patient wants something done and the provider wants to do something, but the data's not there to support this. Maybe one day it will be, but when you consider that, you also have to consider how much, when to give it, which progesterone, how to give it. And we have mm-hmm. none of that data for a threatened miscarriage. Right. You know, so it's kind of, you know, a guessing game. Mm-hmm. And so for threatened miscarriage, I do not prescribe it. Mm-hmm. I'm an academic center and I've never done that, until there's more substantial data and we simply have not had it. Right. So closing thoughts on the role of progesterone for a threatened miscarriage before we go on to recurrent pregnancy loss.
You know, as an REI, I spend a lot of my time monitoring early pregnancies. We don't just get patients pregnant. Contrary to popular belief, we actually mm-hmm. watch those pregnancies mm-hmm. until around the end of the first trimester, and then we send them off to their OB. So, you know, I'm involved a lot in that early monitoring and figuring out which direction are things moving in. And anyone who's thought about getting pregnant or has been pregnant knows that the first trimester is the most tenuous stage of pregnancy where you just don't know which direction things are heading in until you wait and figure it out. So I am always looking at progesterone levels. And one thing I will say is I am on the exact same page, no surprise, as you. Mm-hmm. I don't just throw progesterone at every you know, conceived without the help of IVF or ART pregnancy, because there's bleeding or early signs of this not moving in a positive direction. In fact, I try to really be careful about giving progesterone mm-hmm. because if someone has an irregular pregnancy that's just kind of lingering on because some of those cells are trying to grow and divide and persist, but, you know, it's very clear from the way the HCG is not rising appropriately that this is not a healthy pregnancy, giving progesterone is just going to prolong your agony a lot of the time. You know, it's just not going to allow for that bleeding, that withdrawal bleed to take place and for this to take its course. And in my mind, especially being in fertility, which is such a time-sensitive field or area of medicine, I'm not trying to prolong this. Like I would rather we move on and get through the process of recovery. It takes a long time for the beta HCG sometimes to come down so you can get to your next attempt. So, you know, I make very careful decisions, and I will say, based on the data or the lack thereof, I don't give every single patient with bleeding who has what looks like an early potentially abnormal pregnancy progesterone.
Okay. Another great explanation. And I'm totally on board with that as well. I think that, as an aside, progesterone, as much as I wish it was, it's not a magic cure for fertility and pregnancy issues. We have some really good data on certain things, but in other things, it's definitely lacking, and there has been studies done. So this is just, you know, an example of one of those areas where the role of progesterone is not conclusive and it does not show benefit. But if we move on to recurrent pregnancy loss, it's a little bit more maybe. So first of all, how does ASRM define recurrent pregnancy loss?
Well, the definition used to be that you had to have three, you know, consecutive miscarriages or pregnancy loss for it to be recurrent. And then they actually made it less stringent more recently, and now it's two. And that could even be biochemical pregnancies. It's not that they have to be confirmed to be inside the uterus on ultrasound. So it's more inclusive, and I'm doing a lot more workups for recurrent pregnancy loss than, you know, what we would be doing with the prior definition. So yeah, I think, you know, and I think a lot of us, so as patients, and it's a very difficult place to be. And probably the threshold is a lot lower to say, okay, let's just start progesterone in those scenarios. And some of the data actually, I think, is in support of it.
Yeah. So ACOG defines it as two or more consecutive failed clinical pregnancies as documented by ultrasound or histopathologic examination, which means if you had a pregnancy loss and a DNC was done, or you passed products of conception and that was sent to be examined, then it was confirmed that it was definitely a pregnancy that was there, or, you know, any products of conception. That's what histopathologic or histopathologic means. So the variation varies a little bit, but basically it's two or more. When you're considering IVF, they do include the biochemical pregnancies. So that's something that's a little bit different. But as far as progesterone as a potential intervention or treatment for recurrent pregnancy loss, like I said, the studies are conflicting whether or not it works. But I do think, as you just said, based on there being, and let's back up for a second, consecutive means in a row. So they need to be in a row, two or more in a row. And when you have a live pregnancy, then a loss, then a live pregnancy, then a loss, that's not consecutive. They have to be back to back. So I just want to make sure we clarify that. So we're not talking about people who have had a miscarriage interspersed between live deliveries. So that's not consecutive. Okay. So when you talk about what the ASRM says for recurrent pregnancy loss, they said, and this is from 2012, and you can tell me if something's been updated. Guidelines on the, in patients with three or more consecutive miscarriages immediately preceding their current pregnancy, empiric progesterone administration may be of some benefit. Whereas ACOG says women who experienced or individuals who have experienced at least three prior pregnancy losses may benefit from progesterone therapy in the first trimester. So most of the data is on three or more, right? But there might be an exception made to give it after two. Is that what you're seeing?
Yes, but I wouldn't say that that's a strong guideline. I think that's a little bit antiquated. I think it's more like provider preference, and we're always measuring progesterone levels. So in my personal practice, you know, treating patients, if they have they conceived on their own without treatment and their progesterone level is less than 10 nanograms per milliliter, I'll have a low threshold to say, okay, let's give some supplementation, usually just in the form of vaginal progesterone, and specifically in this type of a setting. And it's mainly just based on some large meta-analyses that were done that showed in patients who've had one or more prior miscarriages in the setting of vaginal bleeding, threatened miscarriage, there might be a slight increased odds of live birth if you give vaginal progesterone.
And again, most of the studies are done on vaginal progesterone. As far as giving progesterone intramuscularly or orally, we don't have that kind of data. So any of the data we have on potentially giving progesterone supplementation for those with recurrent pregnancy loss, again, overall would be two or more losses in a row, would be with vaginal progesterone, right?
Exactly.
Did you see this Cochrane Database Network meta-analysis from 2021? Did you happen to see that one? progestogens for preventing miscarriages and network meta-analysis. So basically they found, you saw that. So basically the conclusion was this: the overall available evidence suggests that progestogens, which is just another name for progesterones or progestins, probably make little or no difference to the live birth rate for those with threatened or recurrent miscarriage. However, vaginal micronized progesterone may increase the live birth rate for those individuals with a history of one or more previous miscarriages, as you just said, and early pregnancy bleeding, with likely no difference in adverse events. But there's still uncertainty over the effectiveness and safety of alternative progestin treatments for threatened and recurrent miscarriage. So again, this is promising because, you know, the Cochrane database is known for doing these big meta-analyses, but it's still not a recommendation, right? So we're not saying this is what, but it's saying maybe.
It could be reasonable.
Yeah, it could be reasonable. Yeah. It's likely not going to hurt, but we really don't know. It's kind of how I read that, right?
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So, and then they also go on to say, again, according to the apparent safety profile, it's not surprising that many experts still recommend and administer such treatment, meaning the vaginal progesterone, but we still don't know or don't have recommendations. And that's because we don't have these recommendations on the indication, preferred dose, the duration, the route of administration, meaning how to get the progesterone, and anything else, because the studies are still not clear cut, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it makes sense that they're not clear cut because the women that they're studying in these clinical studies all have different underlying things going on with them, right? So it's like a hodgepodge of different patients, and it's not going to be the cleanest study ever with this topic. Right.
I mean, it's anytime you're dealing with hormones and outcomes and you have so many other things at play, are we ever going to say, this is what you need to do for this? Probably not. I mean, like, it's just hard with all, because there's so many things at play and you can't get rid of all the other background noise in order to get, does A cause B and so on. So we may not ever get those kind of studies. Yeah, we just have to go by what the totality of the evidence is recommending or pointing to, if that makes sense. Right.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Any other? Yeah, definitely. I think, well, I was just going to say something that we didn't really talk about is I have seen a lot of women who come to me and they've been trying on their own, but they read online, or maybe their OBGYN that doesn't really focus on fertility has reflexively started giving them progesterone like a day or two after they think they've ovulated. And I would caution anyone against doing that, because progesterone changes your lining. Yeah. And, you know, there are some forms of contraception and emergency contraception that use progesterone in that fashion, right? Like, it can make, basically it makes your lining receptive for a very narrow window of time. It's called the window of implantation. So if you just start giving yourself progesterone willy-nilly at random parts of your cycle, you might actually be detracting from your chance of success, because you might be opening up that window of implantation too early before an embryo would even have a chance to get to the uterus. So you don't want to really throw your cycle off that way and make your lining and what's happening in your fallopian tube with an implanting embryo not line up. And sometimes you could actually be working against yourself. So just be careful. It's not a benign thing. I'm not saying it'll be harmful, but it could definitely take away from your chance of success.
Yeah. And I think, and I don't want to sound insensitive here. I really don't. Miscarriage is tough. I've had one myself. It's nobody should have to go through that, but unfortunately people are going to go through that. But what we can't do is just, you know, we'll take this just in hopes that it's going to stick without a real indication to give it. And we do, although the guidelines or any recommendations we have are not perfect, we do have some indications for giving progesterone in these situations. And as Dr. Sikand just said, if you're just taking it just because, or to try to prevent something, you may be working against you, you know, your chances of conception. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, yes. Because I've actually had some patients say, like, I started at this day of my cycle, and I'm like, well, that's before you would actually ovulate, you know, or it's too soon. And that might be why you're having trouble. Yeah. So just be careful, because, you know, these are all intricate processes that are taking place, that sometimes it's seemingly unrelated, but the timing is very important and precise.
Yeah, and just make sure, before we move on to the next topic, but make sure whoever is recommending that you take that progesterone is someone who is used to prescribing it, knows what it's prescribed for, knows you, knows your history, knows why it's being given, and is not just calling you in a prescription, because that's not the proper way to do it. Progesterone, even though it's a natural hormone present in our bodies, giving exogenous, meaning we're giving it to you, your body's not making it, is not without complications. You can't just assume it because it's our body makes it anyway, it's going to be okay. What you don't want it to do is cause any adverse effects, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And I think people get hung up because it's a natural hormone and that, oh, it's natural, my body makes it, I'm just going to take some more. But that's still exogenous administration of it, of a hormone that you're not, your body's not getting. So it's a medication just like anything else. So you have to kind of see it that way.
Believe it or not, I've seen patients who are taking it daily because they've heard it's the pregnancy hormone. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, you're on birth control, right? Because you're basically preventing your body from naturally ovulating on its own.
And one more digression and then I'll move on to the next topic. But I know a lot of, I'm not saying there's no healthcare providers that do this, but I know most of where people are getting this from is from these social media influencers, these groups or whatever that are telling people what to do. Stop doing that. Listen, I know people want to get pregnant. I get it. I've been there, but they're not medical professionals. And getting your information and doing something because someone recommended it in some group or some influencer who has no medical background does not mean that's what you should do. You got to make sure you have someone that knows you, knows your medical history, knows what you're going through before you start taking any kind of exogenous supplements, medication, anything for the purposes of trying to get pregnant or to maintain a pregnancy. Would you agree?
Yes. Amen. I mean, and everyone has a story about someone they know that took progesterone and then that was the end all be it all and the cure. Mm-hmm. So there's more to the story, right? I think this is way oversimplified a lot of the time. And I think you need to consider your own individual situation and talk to someone qualified.
Exactly. Yes. Okay. This is kind of my area of expertise now. Progesterone for preterm birth and short cervix. You don't really have to deal with that, right? Because you're dealing with earlier pregnancy. So do you ever have to deal with that?
Well, I have patients with a history of preterm delivery. And I'll always send them to you guys for preconception counseling and let them know that that's something that is done.
Right. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about progesterone supplementation in a singleton pregnancy. We're not talking about twin gestations today. That's another topic. Singleton pregnancy with no history of preterm birth, but then they develop a short cervix. These are the recommendations for vaginal progesterone. Vaginal progesterone has been studied extensively for this type of patient I just mentioned to reduce the risk of preterm birth. So that's an asymptomatic pregnant individual with a singleton pregnancy, short cervix, and that short cervix is going to be less than 20 millimeters and no prior preterm birth. So basically what you do is you start it at, ideally you want to start it at 16 to 20 weeks, but once your cervix drops below 2 is when you start. I'm crossing over. Forget what I just said. Once the cervix drops below 20 millimeters, and when people are usually figuring that out, is on their 18 to 22 week anatomy scan. Where I work, we're doing cervical lengths for an asymptomatic patients with no history of preterm birth on everybody that comes in for a basic anatomy scan. If their cervix happens to be less than 20, we're recommending vaginal progesterone. We're also not going to talk about cervical insufficiency. That's another topic. This is just for short cervix. So the studies have been done anywhere on less than 20 millimeters to less than 25 millimeters, but in the SFMFM preterm birth kit toolkit, which we use as practitioners, the recommendation is for vaginal progesterone. And these individuals, if their cervical length is less than 20 millimeters and a cerclage is not recommended. A cerclage is for cervical insufficiency, not for asymptomatic short cervix that's closed. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that one's pretty clear cut as far as what our recommendations are for that. For someone who does not have a history of preterm birth, the only type of vaginal progesterone given is vaginal progesterone. That's it. Okay. Now, if you go on to intramuscular progesterone, that we're not giving that. There's no data to show that's the intramuscular progesterone is 17 OHPC. I'm going to say 17P for the purposes of this talk because that's how I refer to it, but we don't give 17P in those individuals without a history of preterm birth. Now, if you go to the individual with progesterone, singleton pregnancy, we're not going to talk about twins, history of preterm birth between 16 and 36 and 6 weeks. Once you hit that 37-week mark, that's not 37 weeks, that is not considered preterm birth. So history of preterm birth between 16 and 36 and 6. So basically what you do is you offer the progesterone supplementation, typically with 17P. Now, there's some recommendations that you could do 17P intramuscular injections or vaginal progesterone, but the data supports more heavily the 17P. But you could talk to your provider. If you fall into that category and you can't tolerate the IM injections, intramuscular injections, there is some thought that doing vaginal progesterone in those patients could be an option. You
I have
want
a
to
quick
start.
question. Are
Yes.
those week are those weekly shots or daily?
Yes.
I can't remember. Okay, they're
We weekly,
weekly.
weekly, weekly.
Got it.
They do hurt. I mean, they're progesterone injections.
Yeah.
Progesterone is thick. It hurts. No matter
Yeah.
how you get it, it hurts. I remember, and I'll digress for a second, when I was taking them, I thought my butt is, my hip, my whatever is battered. I'm going to try my thigh. Bad
Yeah.
idea. Bad
Yeah.
idea. It was awful. I got a huge hematoma and never did it again. I
Yeah.
figured out how to handle it, but no, it's weekly injections. So if you have a history of preterm birth and you start the injections at the 16 to 20 week and 6 day mark, perfectly on the lower end of that. And then you continue those until 36 weeks. If you stop early for whatever reason or miss injections here or there, that's been associated with increased risk of preterm birth. It's not going to be as effective. So basically, this started all before 2011. 17P was produced in local. Oh, this is a good point. Before 2011, the 17P was produced in local and regional compounding pharmacies because there was no 17P product approved by the FDA. But then in 2011, we approved McKenna. So then that was available. Now that's what I use. There is a subcutaneous 17P formulation. It is an auto injector. However, that has not been studied. It is given a different route. We can't say the pharmacodynamics and pharmacokinetics are just the same as the IM route. And that just means how you give a medication, whether it's oral, rectal, vaginal, intramuscular, subcutaneous, how that drug distributes in your body and works is going to vary. But because we had the data on the IM, the FDA approved the subQ auto injector. But it's important to know that we don't have studies specifically on the 17P auto injector for the prevention of preterm birth. So just talk to your provider about that. I imagine the auto injector is probably easier than the IM injections. I would not doubt that, but just know that all the studies were done on the IM injections.
Do you have patients that use the subcutaneous one?
I'm not going to because my
Yeah.
patients are indigent and on Medicaid. Medicaid's not going to
Got
help.
it,
I
got it,
approve
got it.
that.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it is what it is.
Yeah.
But I've had a lot of people reach out to me that are on it. And I'm not going to say not to take it. It's just that we don't have those studies. And all the
Right.
trials that were done on 17P were all IM injections.
Right,
So
right,
this is
right.
important to know. I mean, I don't know. But
I think I would go with what's been proven. That's just how I am,
I would too. Our
obviously.
evidence brains, evidence-based brains think alike. But you know, I could if the patient had the insurance that would approve it, and they are counseled and say, "Listen, we don't have the data specifically. It's on IM, and they still want the subcutaneous auto injector." Would I let them? Not let them.
Yeah.
Would I approve that? Yes, of course I would, as long as I counsel them on what we do and do not know about the auto injector.
That makes
Okay,
sense.
yeah. And then there's cervical link monitoring for somebody with a history of preterm birth. Basically, what happens, you have a history of preterm birth, right? You're going to get counseled more than likely on the 17P injections along with the serial cervical links. And then, if your cervical link drops below 2.5, of course, the threshold is lower for those with a history of preterm birth than those without. Remember, those without a history of preterm birth, the cervical link has to be less than 2. For those with preterm birth history, less than 2.5. Then you have offer them a cerclage. If you were taking 17P, your cervix drops below 2.5 and you get a cerclage, you can continue the 17P. There's some thought to add vaginal progesterone or switch. There's no hard and steadfast data on what to do about that. For me, if they're already on 17P injections, they continue it after the cerclage is placed. Now, say that you decided, I just want serial cervical links with my history of preterm birth. I don't want those injections. Then your cervix drops below 2.5. I'm going to offer you a cerclage and or vaginal progesterone. But where we're at, it's usually just a cerclage. And if they get the cerclage, we don't do anything else. Although there's some individuals or some practices that if they were never on progesterone and they get a cerclage, they'll add vaginal progesterone too. I don't specifically do that because there's no clear-cut recommendations. So those are important things to know. What your options are with a history of preterm birth, but the most important thing is to know you have a history of preterm birth so you tell your provider and that they talk to you about progesterone and cervical length surveillance in your pregnancy. That's the, you know, you don't have to know all these details, but know I have a history of delivering at 32 weeks, know why you delivered at 32 weeks so they can determine if you are a candidate for serial cervical length measurements and progesterone. For example, if you delivered early because you were preeclamptic, that's not preterm birth from cervical issues. It's different. So that's because you had a different medical condition that required that. So is that clear as mud?
I mean, no, it's pretty simple. It's pretty simple and clear. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good PSA because a lot of people listening today, you know, are maybe first time pregnancies or not pregnant yet. And I think it's just good to know that there is a strategy out there that exists to look out for signs or, you know, a warning that there could be a preterm delivery and there's things you can potentially do about it. And if you've ever had even like a second trimester loss, right, because the cervix opened up, there's something that you can do moving forward to prevent it from happening again.
Well, as an aside, you know, and I do all high risk obstetrics, so I deal with this all the time. Mm-hmm. I've seen patients not know why they delivered early, not know, you know, under the circumstances, you know, sometimes they can't even tell me where they delivered. Right. Listen, it's important that you know all of that. And if you deliver early and you don't understand why, do not leave until someone sits you down and tells you why you delivered early. Don't. Mm-hmm. You've got to ask questions, and it's your right to ask questions. I don't know how much of it is the patient's not asking or the provider's not telling. It's probably a combination of both, but either way, the patient needs to leave knowing exactly what happened, right?
Yes. Yeah, because, of course.
And but I
it's going to inform what you do moving forward.
I see it all the time, all the time. And that's just telling me there's lack of communication there. And we need to make that better. So if you're listening to this and you have a complicated pregnancy or you deliver early, make sure you know before you leave the hospital why you delivered early and exactly what that means for your next pregnancy.
And along those same lines, I think if someone's telling you that you need to be on progesterone or you need to start reflexively taking it, ask questions. You're allowed to ask questions and understand what's happening with your body. And maybe after having that discussion, you'll figure out that maybe there are other tests or things that need to be looked into before trying to slap that Band-Aid on.
Right, right. Yeah. And and this is the other thing too, with the history of preterm birth, more does not mean better, because you don't want a cerclage and the vaginal progesterone and the IM progesterone and the oral. No, we don't know yet if taking too much progesterone is going to be a problem in your pregnancy. So we have studies, although they're not perfect, but they are giving recommendations and they are really decent studies. That's what I'm going to follow until I know otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to assume, oh, you know, just add this and then add that. It's not going to hurt. I don't know it's not going to hurt.
Right.
I don't know that, but I do know that the studies have shown that X, Y, and Z, the outcomes are this, and that's what I'm going to go by. Okay. Here's a good question for you. I bet you know about this. Mm-hmm. Bioidentical progesterone injections. Have you done any, I don't know, are you familiar with bioidentical hormones? One of them is this Napro technology that are used, progesterone for preterm birth, pregnancy loss, threat miscarriage. What do you know about that?
So bioidentical hormones are not regulated, and you might be getting different formulations and different types of hormone or amounts of hormone. And it's not something that is predictable and consistent. So I'm very against bioidentical hormones.
Amen. I had a feeling you would say that, but we actually didn't talk about this. I promise you, we did not talk about this. Yes. I kind of added this on today. Why did I want to talk about this? Because I had a commenter on an Instagram post say that bioidentical hormones, they specifically talked about Napro technology. I guess it's a company that does bioidentical hormones. And let's back up. Bioidentical hormones were most commonly used for menopausal individuals. Okay. Mm-hmm. But then they kind of branched out into all these other things, and they scooped up the preterm birth because progesterone, and the miscarriage because of progesterone, and the threat miscarriage because of progesterone. And so now they're treating that. So I looked into it, and because this individual said it's better than McKenna, the 17P injections, superior to, and there is absolutely zero evidence that that is true.
Yeah, it's just the marketing statements.
Dude, I was like, what do you mean? I'm an MFM, and I didn't know that. I'm like,
you're not up to date.
I'm like, shoot, how does she know? No, I looked, and nothing. Nada.
Oh, that's
but
crazy.
This individual was told this. There's no evidence that the bioidentical progesterone for miscarriage, preterm birth, any of that works, nor has there ever been a study that compares any bioidentical hormone formulation to McKenna or 17P. But the whole thought about progesterone is they do some kind of saliva test, and they decide based on certain parameters that you need this kind of progesterone.
It's tailored to you.
It's tailored to you, but it's all, I'm going to say it, it's voodoo. Okay, it's voodoo. It's not regulated. Yeah. They go by their custom made for you. And as Dr. Seekon said at the very beginning, things wax and wane. How are you going to customize that? It's nearly impossible, right? So first of all, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
The hormone levels in your saliva are not going to reflect the hormone levels in your blood ever. Yeah. That's another thing to know.
Then,
according to the FDA and several medical specialty groups, the hormones marketed as bioidentical and natural. Of course, that's, natural is always.
Yeah, that's the buzzword.
That's the buzzword. Aren't safer than hormones used in traditional hormone therapy. There is no evidence they are effective. Mm-hmm. So be wary of the bioidentical hormone scam, because I guarantee you it's not cheap. It's a way to make money. When you're dealing with fertility, pregnancy, and a vulnerable population that's going through this, of course those individuals want to do what's ever best for the pregnancy. I get it. Mm-hmm. But I hate this part of it.
Yeah, no, of course. Right? How do they, and I don't understand like how a manufacturer of something like that, where they're spinning this story, can sleep at night. I mean, even if it's not for the moral issues with it, I would be so afraid that like there could be bad outcomes because this is not proven to be a suitable alternative. And then what's the recourse, you know? And I guess they're just not banking on people organizing themselves and actually looking into
that. That has to be it, because I can't think of any other reason. And it's really unfortunate that this is happening. But it's the same thing with prenatal vitamins. And we talk about this all the time. There's a loophole with the FDA that it's a supplement.
Right.
It's natural. And we got to stop with all of this stuff, because it's hurting individuals. And we have data on 17P. Insurance covers 17P. Mm-hmm. Insurance covers, for the most part, vaginal progesterone. I mean, I work with mostly Medicaid patients. It covers it for them. So I'm assuming it will for everybody else.
Right.
Why are we doing this? Now, this commenter's physician recommended it.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. There's probably a reason why.
Yeah.
That physician recommended it, is all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
So what we presented here is what the data shows. And again, although it's not perfect science, it's what we know. There's ongoing studies. And I just also want to add on here, I'm sure you heard with the prolonged trial for the 17P for prevention of preterm birth, how everybody's coming out saying 17P needs to be withdrawn from the market and not given to individuals with history of preterm birth. But SNFM came out with a statement regarding the MEES trial, which is the original 17P trial versus the prolonged trial. And based on that, the prolonged trial was not the best trial, and we've had multiple in support of 17P. So SNFM and me, we still stand behind 17P. So that's why it is still available and not been pulled from the market based on one study that was not exactly the best study. Mm-hmm. So for those of you that might ask, that's the situation for 17P. If your provider recommends it and you have questions, just, you know, they can talk to you what the SNFM said. Had you heard about that?
I remember hearing about that controversy. When did that happen? When was it pulled?
It wasn't pulled.
Or when was there discussion around
so
it?
So that would have been, the prolonged trial was, let me find it, 2018. I think it was published in 2019.
So this was after I got out of, like, I was at a residency and I was so subspecialized. So I think I heard like peripheral whispering about it, but never was intricately involved with it.
The key thing to remember is none of these trials, even the prolonged trial, said it was bad for you.
Right.
It was going to hurt the pregnancy. It just did not show the same prevention of preterm birth rates that the other trials did. Mm-hmm. But when you put the totality of the evidence together, which SNFM did in the statement they released, the evidence still supports the use of 17P for the prevention of preterm birth. I still use it. All my colleagues still use it. And so we still offer it to our patients. So for what that's worth. Let's just see. We have about 5 minutes to see if there's any questions. There's a lot of people here.
This was a great review for me because I haven't really thought about pregnancy beyond the first trimester when it comes to progesterone. It's been a while.
I love... you know, when you go to those CME articles that we have to do for our maintenance. I'm just like, I think they'll say everybody was listening. They must've done a really good job of our explanation.
I mean, it was a comprehensive 360 review of progesterone.
It totally was. Okay. This is you, all you. Can you talk about how to investigate and treat a potential pituitary signaling issue?
So you can test for the hormones directly, right? So if someone's not on birth control, I mentioned that because a lot of hormonal birth controls are going to suppress your pituitary hormones, then you can actually measure their follicle stimulating hormone, their luteinizing hormone at the same time as estrogen and progesterone. That's very important. A lot of people come to me with lab work that's incomplete because just looking at some of those things in isolation is not going to give me the whole picture. It's just one piece of the puzzle. So being able to understand what's happening at the level of the ovary, what's happening at the level of your pituitary gland in your brain is going to give me the best clue about whether there is suppression of those hormones. If your pituitary cannot produce or release those hormones, that could be an underlying cause of having a short luteal phase because there's messaging from your brain to your ovary, right? Mm-hmm. And if that messaging is not happening, then what's going to tell your ovary to completely ovulate and, you know, for the corpus luteum to do what it's supposed to do downstream of that? So the first step is blood work. And then if you identify that the levels are low, you also have to look into why. And there are many different reasons why that could be. Having certain types of low thyroid function can mean that the gland above the pituitary is actually releasing even more hormone to try to get the thyroid to work. And that can cause suppression of the pituitary, which is kind of confusing. You can also have benign growths inside your pituitary gland, which are actually, I wouldn't say common, but they're not rare. Mm-hmm. And they produce high levels of something called prolactin, which consequently mm-hmm. is also a hormone that is responsible for breast milk production. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that can turn off those signals. So there's a lot of indirect connections, and you have to do a full investigation to really understand all the different players and what makes you ovulate normally.
Yeah. And when you're talking, and you mentioned this, when you are talking about doing hormone levels and FSH, LH, just there is a science behind when to draw these. You can't just say, go to the lab and get this drawn. It depends on what you're trying to assess.
Yes.
Is when you need to draw things. And so if the provider doesn't understand that, all these labs are not going to mean anything.
Right.
You got to understand why you're doing it, when's the best time to do it, to assess why you're doing it, and what exactly you need to assess for what you're trying to investigate. And that's very true for everything regarding anything hormonal, especially in pregnancy or for trying to conceive. So making sure they understand, I've had patients come to me with a slew of labs that meant absolutely nothing, because they were drawn at the wrong time or they weren't the right labs and there's nothing I can do with them. So having a provider that knows what they're drawing, when to draw it, what to actually get to assess what they're trying to assess is key. Would you agree?
Yes, exactly. And there's so many different reasons why you could have problems with your pituitary gland. But you have to do a really thorough investigation to be able to, in a targeted fashion, fix the underlying problem.
Yeah, I think that's really key. So I was never good at anything endocrinology, especially not, I remember, what was the main book for endocrinology?
Spiroff.
So that name
that's my Bible.
I'm sure you can keep it. You can have it. It's fine. I found it fascinating, but my brain never really got it. And that's why there's you.
Yeah. No, but we're on both ends of the same spectrum. Yeah, yeah. So it works great.
Where you leave off, I'll continue with the pregnancy stuff. So thank you, Dr. Seacon, as always. This is an excellent discussion. For those of you that are listening, I really like working and doing these things with Dr. Seacon. And it's not like we are saying, okay, listen, you say this and I say that. We are actually very much on the same page because we're both very like-minded in how to do evidence-based medicine and making sure that we advise our patients the right way. And now, are we black and white when it comes to that? No. I mean, you still have to do things individually for your patients, but for teaching purposes and educational purposes, you need to know how to look at the evidence and also teach it if you want. That's kind of what we're doing here.
Yes.
But the other thing along the same lines with evidence-based medicine, that means we're going by what the literature says, the data says. We look at how the studies are done, you know, the patient population. There's so much looking into whether or not a research article is even a good one. Mm-hmm. But what you don't want to do is, and I'm sure you have, they will disagree with what I say and they'll send me this one article that says the opposite of what I said.
How convenient. Okay?
That is, you're right. That article does say that. However, when you look at the totality of the evidence and what everything else says, and we put it all together, this is what the recommendation is. And that's why we have ASRM, ACOG, SMFM, because that's all they do. They look at the totality and put forth recommendations. So there's something to be said when there's a medical organization like ASRM, SNFM, ACOG that are putting forth recommendations, because that's
and not
their
trying
job.
To sell you something.
And not trying to sell you something. And not trying to say you need to go to that bioidentical hormone place and get mm-hmm. and place out of the pot. No. Mm-hmm. They have what the patient's best interests are. So that's what following evidence-based medicine means. It doesn't mm-hmm. mean this one article says this, so I'm going to change everything. If that mm-hmm. were the case, Dr. Seekon and I would be changing what we do every single day, probably 10 times a day, according right. to some article, right?
Exactly.
That's not what you do. That's not good for patients.
No, no. So, and we're here to bust myths and, you know, misconceptions, which there's too many of them, especially mm-hmm. on social media.
Oh yeah, somebody came after me yesterday and said and sent me this one article, and I'm like, I can't argue that yes, that's what the article says, but it's not going to change anything. It's one article, right. Small patient population that is not the best designed study, but that's why we're here. That's why these medical organizations are here. To help put forth recommendations for those that weren't trained to assess studies and weren't trained to look at study design. That's why they're here. And that's why we're doing what we do, right?
Exactly. And thank you for everything that you do and for having me on to discuss this. This is such an important topic.
Yes, and you too. I really appreciate you backing me up, and I'll always back you up because, again, we're very like-minded, which is nice to have in someone that whose specialties are so closely related, because we are very closely related in what we do. So. Have a good awesome. Rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
For something else, I'm sure. But thank you for taking time out of your day to talk to of myself course. And all these people listening.
Good luck on your 24-hour call.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that discussion. Now listen to the next episode on medication safety and pregnancy.